Time is not on Volodymyr Zelensky's side. Ukraine's president on a tour of 5 European cities in 2 days as he seeks the green light for longer-range missile strikes inside Russia from NATO allies. In a week that's seen his side lose two key towns in the Donbas region, fate conspiring against Zelensky as Hurricane Milton kept Joe Biden away from a now-scrapped summit of allies in Germany. With November 5th fast approaching and U.S. voters' enthusiasm for backing Ukraine waning, how does Kyiv handle the prospect of an eventual return of Donald Trump to the White House? A new book by Watergate journalist Bob Woodward purports to shed more light on the cozy relationship between the Republican candidate and the master of the Kremlin, Vladimir Putin, who Trump has referenced more than ever in upbeat terms on the campaign trail, as we'll hear. Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at Ukraine, Putin, and Trump. And who needs Bob Woodward when we have our own investigative reporter who's been scrutinizing the ties that bind the former president and Putin, France 24. Tbilisi correspondent Régis Janté, your new book out next week. Translation is Our Man in Washington.
Yeah.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for invitation.
When's the translation in English?
This I don't know.
Okay. Anton Kozlov is the director of the International Center for the Study of Eurasia. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Thank you.
From London, Ariza Lutsevich, who is the director for Russia and the Eurasia program at the think tank Chatham House. Welcome to the show. And from Kyiv, political consultant and commentator Jason J. Smart. Welcome.
It's great to see you. Thank you.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. Before we talk about November 5th in the United States, let's talk about the reality of the ground in Ukraine on this October the 10th. Russia taking 2 key towns in the past week in that eastern Donbas region, one of them Vuhledar. Between there and Moscow-occupied Donetsk City, France 24's Catherine Norris Trent filed this exclusive report from the Ukrainian side of the front line.
We're driving at dusk to a secret position on a tree line in southeastern Ukraine, one of the most intensive areas of fighting in the country right now. Here, shelling has long been a constant, but it's intensified even more in recent weeks. Haram, the artillery position's commander, who's nearly 50, was mobilized last year.
They're no more than 6 kilometers away, but what's interesting is that their presence seems denser. I don't know about the exact ratios of equipment, but in terms of the shelling, for every 2 shots we fire, they fire 7.
Outside, under cover of nightfall, he shows us the Soviet-era artillery gun at his disposal and says that even though they're actively rationing ammunition, they've been having some success.
We're firing at tanks and heavy machinery. Hitting a moving target directly is very difficult. But even if we hit nearby, it causes damage. And so they stop.
Day and night, this is how these men from the 33rd Mechanized Brigade of Ukraine's army spend their time trying to hold the front line in eastern Ukraine, one of the most intensive areas of fighting at the moment in this long, drawn-out war. In recent weeks, this brigade stopped 2 major Russian onslaughts, the fiercest they've seen in the year they've been stationed in the south of the Donetsk region.
That was a big push from the Russian side. Previously we were fighting on Zaporizhzhia direction, and that was a tough direction too, but there was less of drones, less of FPVs. That's hard war.
This drone unit witnessed how Ukrainians were pushed back further north on the Eastern Front in the summer.
When the enemy began to advance, we couldn't evacuate the injured or deliver supplies, ammunition or medication. The terrain was such that you couldn't move without being seen.
Their battalion has specialists who upgrade drones into kamikaze attack machines.
We make around 15 drones per day minimum. So that's about 60 to 80 drones for a four-day rotation. We make these drones and then take them with us to the battlefield position.
This large-scale Ukrainian-made drone named the Vampire can carry explosives, but also vital supplies of food and water to infantry troops stationed right at the front. But they cost $20,000 each, often funded by volunteers. Russia has ramped up its attack drone production on a massive scale. Vladimir Putin says his country will make 1.4 million this year alone. Ukraine's soldiers and political leaders are renewing calls for their allies to fulfill pledges of arms deliveries if they're to keep holding the long and vulnerable eastern front line.
Ariza Lutsevich, we see in that report, on the one hand, courage, incredible ingenuity, being able to make your own weapons on the front line and then use them. And on the other hand, the sort of the weariness of the Russian onslaughts that continue. What's this next winter going to be like?
Well, Francois, it's been a very difficult year for Ukrainian armed forces, starting with delays of American assistance, the $60 billion package, where Russia clearly had an advantage in artillery 1 to 10. Then the situation leveled up. I mean, Ukrainians have actually performed quite a successful operation by capturing part of Russian territory. Let's not forget, over 1,000 square kilometers, while Russians are making inroads into Donbas, losing a lot of their men, kind of these minced meat attacks of infantry. And obviously, if the current level of assistance is not sustained and even increased, Ukrainians will be losing more territory. You know, war is mathematics. If it's crucial for Europe, for Ukraine to prevail, it has to provide more assistance faster. And Ukraine is also ramping up its own production. President Zelensky said there is a capacity now to produce 4 million drones. For this year, they have procured 1.5 million of those machines. But it's about the type of technology. Ukraine needs more advanced technology, faster and at bigger scale. Otherwise, Russia will have an advantage because it has more power and also more production capacity.
Jason J. Smart, sitting in Kyiv, where you are, you know, on the one hand, and you just heard Arisia say it, you know, the Ukrainians talking up the casualty toll on the Russian side, talking up this incursion in the Kursk region of Russia. But what's the mood where you are right now?
Well, obviously, there is concern. I mean, there's no way to get around that. The fact is that every day is more loss of life. Ukrainian civilians are dying, not just soldiers. But also, I think there is optimism. Overall, Russia has lost 1,000 kilometers that's being occupied now by Ukraine of Russian territory. Russia in the past year has only gained 0.1% of Ukraine's territory. 0.1%, and that's cost hundreds of thousands of lives. So ultimately, I think it is not so easy for Russia. These gains or towns that had populations before the war of, say, 10,000 people or so, it's actually not that tremendous what Russia has been able to do. But of course, for people in Ukraine, they have family at the front, they have friends at the front, and every day there are people dying as a result of Vladimir Putin's decision to legally invade Ukraine.
Yeah, and Régis Jeanté, we saw those images there just from earlier of the Ukrainian president here in Paris. And we'll talk more about his barnstorming tour. But the best Emmanuel Macron could do is talk about work continuing on more military supplies. It brings us to the subject of November the 5th. If Donald Trump is elected, what happens?
Yeah, that's the very key issue, not only for Ukraine, but for really the world geopolitics, of course. So what will happen? I think it's quite clear when Mr. Trump says that within 24 hours he can solve the conflict. We all know that he can't within 24 hours make Mr. Putin stopping this war. So it means that he prefers, or he thinks that this is on Ukraine that he will act, and just by stopping to deliver armaments to Ukraine. So this is quite clear. And when we look at the history of Mr. Trump and his history with Russians, I would say it's quite clear that he was always in favor of Russia, not since 5 years, not since 10 years, but since 84, basically. When I try to look for my book on this history, the first examples where Mr. Trump was speaking about world politics was in 84, about the nuclear disarmament, the nuclear disarmament. He wanted to be the intermediary between Soviet Union and the US under the Reagan administration. And already at that time, he was on the Russian side. He was really proposing some plans which were really good for Russia. So I think this is what he says a lot about what we could expect after the 5th of November if Mr. Trump is elected.
So your book's about to come out just, and we'll talk later about the Bob Woodward book, but it's also coming out at the time when in French movie houses we've seen this biopic, The Apprentice, which chronicles Donald Trump's coming of age. And in your book, you talk about Trump's first exposure to Soviet culture in Brooklyn and Queens.
Yeah, exactly. That's important in his life, indeed, because he was a real estate developer, and through his father and the company that was run by his father, you could meet in Brooklyn this kind of people, what I call the Red Mafia, and then these people were really eager to invest in Trump's projects and also to launder their money in Trump's casinos. So there is a long history, and this is probably through this kind of people that finally Moscow, the KGB, was able to cultivate Mr. Trump in the 70s, in the 80s mostly, and 90s.
We were 8 years ago when there was the 2016 election. There were these allegations of some kinds of business deals between Donald Trump and the Russians. There was never any formal proof of that. So, Anton Kozlov, is this just sort of an impression, or is there something when it comes to Russia that Donald Trump has?
Well, I don't know whether there is a connection, you know, but for sure he has a weak spot for Putin, for Russia. He was in charge of the beauty contest in Moscow. I think he is very kind of keen on Russian women, although I must say that those people in Brooklyn and Queens, are most of them are not Russian. They're basically, they all come from Ukraine and from back in the Soviet days. So, no, I think he likes Russia. I think he likes to be received as a big shot. And he, aesthetically, he's very much like those Brighton crowd people. He's vulgar. He's uneducated, and he likes things that are, you know, kind of very simple populist kind of things. So I'm not at all surprised. And also, he's in real estate and development. It's a mafia business in New York, as you probably know. And so all those Russians working in development, I don't know about real estate, but development for sure, they all have mafia connections.
Jason J. Smart, these are allegations. This is stuff that's been around for a long time. What do you make of, is there a sort of a fascination on the part of Trump for Russia?
He definitely has an unusual interest, and I agree with what the earlier ones had said, is that the fact is it goes back a few decades. It's not something recent, and it's pretty well documented. He has had an ongoing interest in Russia, and he seems to have a personal love for Vladimir Putin, which is also quite strange and hard to understand. But he does often reference him and references him very positively, and it's something that makes him quite unique for world leaders, that he is so unabashed in what he feels about the Russian dictator.
Now, in your book, Régis Jeantet, you write of a common outsider's kind of vibe. Both men often express their anger against the establishment. For Trump, that's incarnated by Democrats. For Putin, by the Moscow elite. All the while, both are the greatest of protectors of the powerful.
Yeah, that's something which is they have in common. They have a lot of difference. Of course, they are coming from two different worlds. But indeed, they have this in common. They hate. Trump always says, you know, I hate nice people. He says this very often. So this is, and somehow Putin also hates what he called nice people, you know, the Democrats, the people speaking about human rights and so on. That's indeed important in the characters. But then for Putin, it's really about rationality, try to defend how he sees the interest of Russia. And this is not only about Putin, because again, the story started much before, and we have a lot of elements. Maybe we don't have the final proof because we don't have the file coming from
they
the,
sure looked
from
for
the
it
KGB.
In 2016.
Yeah, but we have so many people around Mr. Trump, so many emails which were in the hands, for example, of the Mueller Council, who did a big report for the Department of Justice in the U.S. about the involvement of Russia into the elections. And through that, we can see a big gallery of very powerful people, often with a criminal background, but also so very close with the security services from Russia and very close to Mr. Putin. The first trip that Mr. Trump did in Moscow was in July 87. July 87. And the way he was invited to Moscow, and I had several sources.
This is before Gorbachev is still absolutely the head of the Soviet Union.
Exactly. And all the sources we have, and we have a lot of information on the way, on why he was invited there. We have a lot of information showing that this is typically a KGB operation. Well, he was invited, for example, with the Intourist organization, which was the state tourist organization, which was, as we know, really totally in the hands of the KGB at the time. And when he came back, 2 months later, he published an opinion in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and Boston Globe, saying, you know, we should stop to pay for the defense of the others, the NATO members, and Japan. Exactly with the same words that he's still using 30 years later.
Aresia Lutsevich, again, there's a long trail of smoke that dates back, according to Regis, to 1987. But is there fire?
Well, there was fire in 2016 when there was a summit in Helsinki between U.S. and Russia, and when basically then President Trump sided with Putin and confirmed against their own probe and FBI investigation that Russians were not interfering in elections. Putin just told me. So you see, have this romance of a strong man who, in a way, I think Trump is partially jealous of how Putin can run Russia. And that he admires that strong power. That's why so many American experts and commentators are nervous about what the second Trump presidency could do to American democracy. And also one more thing that is very dangerous for Ukraine, since we are discussing Ukraine. I think Russians convinced Trump that it were Ukrainians who are interfering in American elections and not the Russians. I think this is one of their most successful influence operations on Trump, where he publicly was in that call then what revealed between the President Zelensky and President Trump asking for a server because he believed the National Democratic Convention's server was for some reason in Ukraine's hands. And that kind of was interesting that after the recent trip to Washington and that meeting between Zelensky and Trump, he spent 1 minute in his press conference saying, you see, President Zelensky said the impeachment was hoax. I think Zelensky was trying to play it nice to appease Trump ahead of his possible presidency. But Ukraine is very much in a hot spot, and it's also personal for Trump. That is why it's so dangerous for Ukraine.
All right, that brings us perhaps to that other book. The Kremlin confirms that Donald Trump sent Vladimir Putin COVID tests when he was president, but says it was part of an international exchange at the start of the pandemic. Bob Woodward's book also claims that since he's left office, Trump's spoken 7 times with Putin, including once shooing away aides and friends at Mar-a-Lago so he could talk in private. The Trump campaign flatly denies. You have doubts, Régis Jeantet, over some of those post-presidency conversations between Trump and Putin?
No, I mean, I don't know. I think Mr. Woodward has one source on that, so it's not absolutely enough, but it's that's possible. And when we understand the kind of relations that they have, that makes sense, that's possible. I think there is another book which is very interesting from Mr. McMaster, who used to be at the National Security Council in the U.S. and reveals a lot.
For example, under Donald Trump.
Under Donald Trump, exactly. Exactly. And generally, for example, he was in Hamburg when, for the first time, Mr. Putin and Trump met face to face for the first time in their life, even. And that was very interesting because at that time, for example, Putin said to Mr. Trump that you know, the Ukrainians, if you continue to feed them, to give them armament, they will always ask for more. So it's like a kind of commercial trade behind this and so on. And 7 years later, few weeks ago, when Mr. Zelensky was in Washington, met Mr. Trump. After some time, Trump criticized Mr. Zelensky after he left back to Ukraine and spoke exactly with the same words, saying, "Oh, you know, Mr. Zelensky is a kind of traitor. He always wants more. He wants to have more armament." So he used again the same words, the same arguments that Mr. Putin was trying to put in his mind 7 years before.
Which brings us to the topic of November the 5th and. Volodymyr Zelensky began his day in London. He had a three-way sit-down with the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer and the new NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who in his previous incarnation as NATO Secretary General had often had the reputation of being that European leader who could get through to Trump. It seemed as though he was, again, staying on that message when Mark Rutte spoke with reporters earlier.
Really, stop worrying about a Trump presidency. We do not know who will win. I will work with Kamala Harris if she is chosen. I will work with Donald Trump when he will be chosen.
And but you're not worried about President Trump withdrawing support for Ukraine?
I'm not worried about that because I'm absolutely convinced that the US is in this because they understand that it's not only for Ukraine but also for them. And that from Washington to San Francisco, the whole of the US would be less secure if Putin would be successful in Ukraine.
It's not just about one man, is the argument Mark Rutte says. And we saw that, right? Anton Kozlov, everything that Régis Jeantet was saying during the first presidency of Trump that was feared, people like H.R. McMaster pushed back on it. And the Pentagon still went ahead and pushed for military armament for Ukraine. Is the new NATO Secretary General correct?
Absolutely. I think if Ukraine loses, the West, what they call in Russia the collective West, is going to lose too.
But does the rest of the U.S. Quote-unquote establishment, those who make decisions in Washington, understand that and are they willing?
I hope a lot of people do. I think I talk to a lot of American analysts and a lot of American experts. I think everybody understands what this is about. I think only Donald Trump and maybe people around him don't understand, those people on the far right. But everybody else and professional people, the deep state, as they call them, understands that very well.
Jason J. Smart, how does it work in Washington? Can the president alone make those kinds of decisions, like from one day to the next, to cut military aid, to cut financial aid to Kyiv?
Well, the president is going to be limited on a number of different things. For instance, the Congress passed in the past few months things that make it harder if Trump were to win for him to take the U.S. out of NATO. But as far as it goes with Ukraine specifically, the president does have the prerogative of choosing packages to be sent to Ukraine, though it is Congress that appropriates the money. However, should the president of the United States decide that he wishes to slow that down or to change the sort of packages or to just not give the right to other countries to send U.S. military goods that they happen to have to Ukraine, the president could do that, yes.
But will it be the same scenario as last time he was president if he's elected?
If he wins this time, it's a very good question. But I think that most anybody who studies Russia or Putin would say that Donald Trump would probably try to end the war as quickly as he could, and that would operate against the interest of Ukraine and work right into the hands of Putin.
Yeah, Donald Trump, who the New York Times reports has mentioned the Russian leader by name during the campaign 41 times at rallies this year, far more than in any year since he first became a presidential candidate in 2015. Actually, make it 42 times with Wednesday's rally in Pennsylvania.
The Ukraine disaster, millions of dead people because of the weakness of this administration. Putin never would have gone into Ukraine if I were president. It would never, ever have happened.
That the statement there, Rysia Lutsevich, what can happen on day one, as Donald Trump claims?
Well, first, this is a very consistent campaign statement. It doesn't mean that this will immediately translate into policy. I think there's a big question looming over how it will be perceived in a close Trump circle, the role of China and Russia. Because I think there may be an interest where they say, let's settle war in Ukraine so that we can sway and decouple Russia from China because this is too dangerous. They are becoming too much embedded, and Russia becomes really a vassal state of China eventually if this continues. There could be another strategy that if Ukraine loses, China will be emboldened. American power projection in Southeast Asia, in Latin America will be damaged because, as we do know, the world, the global South, the non-Western hemisphere sees that America is at war with Russia with this in Ukraine. And what is more disturbing, they do think that Russia will prevail, Russia will win, given how incremental support is to Ukraine and how difficult it is for Ukraine to keep defending the front line. So I think we're still looking at the equation with a lot of unknowns. There are different groupings within the Trump circle, such as Mike Pompeo, who is trying to argue actually a case of a land lease for Ukraine that would to give a sustainable and increased assistance to Ukrainian military. And there are others who may want to play this Russia-China game. But there's also Putin, who is preparing his special scenario. This one, I don't know who has insights, but I am sure he will be making an offer to Trump that will include the trap. And that trap will be, you know, to weaken Europe and eventually to get America out of Europe, because this is what President Putin wants. He wants America out of Eastern Europe. So far, he's spectacularly failing to achieve it, but this is his ultimate goal of this war. And let's remember the ultimatum he sent to Washington on the eve of invasion in 21.
So just to be clear, Arisa, just to recap what you just said, in other words, in Trump's circle, it's the argument over which matters more, Ukraine or China. And if China matters more, then if I follow your logic, it's not a good idea to disengage from Ukraine.
It's important for them to take a decision how they want to weaken China. And they may want to see as an opportunity to pull Russia into the Western camp, so to speak. And Russia may play the game by pretending it's doing it, and Ukraine will be salvaged into this operation. It will be a collateral damage of a bigger game.
Anton Kozlov?
Well, frankly, I don't think they can pull Russia now into the Western orbit. I think it's going to be very, very difficult, practically impossible, at least while Putin is in the office. I think maybe when he's out and he's replaced, maybe we can start talking about it. But I think at this point, Putin basically destroyed not only 30 years of what had been built since the end of the Soviet Union, but basically he's undermining the last 300 years of what been taking place in Russia since the days of Peter the Great and even his father. So I think this is something very interesting, actually, for a historian like myself to see this. But it's also very dangerous.
You talk about the nativist streak in the United States, Régis Jeantet, and the imperialist streak as well.
Yeah.
So they kind of conflate here. This is the confusing part. Clear it up for us, please.
I don't know. It's a very big issue because you can look at the war in Ukraine on many I mean, from many point of view, the imperialism is extremely important indeed. And this is the way, by the way, that Mr. Putin is talking also and to Mr. Trump. And it was revealed in these books. I'm not sure it is in Woodward's book, but in McMaster it is, when, for example, to try to convince Mr. Trump that he should not support Ukraine, he said, you know, finally, he make a comparison with the Monroe Doctrine. So you say, and Trump is...
Which is, just to explain for our viewers, the Monroe Doctrine is that you hands off the Americas. That's our...
Exactly. And Trump is an isolationist. So he wants to the U.S. to not be too much involved abroad, and indeed to keep to make sure that the surrounding of what is around the U.S., basically the American Americas, should be, no one should be involved there. And Trump, Mr. Putin, to talk to Trump, to make him to understand and to support him finally, explaining that it's the same finally for the U.S. and it's try to apply the kind of Monroe Doctrine to the Eurasian continent, to Russia. And that's really, really important in this way, because he managed to find always his way to convince Mr. Trump. And on the same meeting, which was in Hamburg in 2017, something is quite amazing on what happened there. Mr. Trump asked Mr. Putin if he thought that it was a good idea that the U.S. should continue to provide armament to Ukraine. And of course, Mr. Putin, which is aggressing Ukraine, said no. So the fact that he can ask this question to Mr. Putin says a lot about the kind of relation they have and who is the master in this duo.
Jason J. Smart, of course, Donald Trump's become much more worldwise, right? In his third bid for the U.S. presidency. Let me ask you, Jason, the United States of 2024, is it more isolationist than it was 4 or 8 years ago?
So as a whole, I would imagine that is not more isolationist. The U.S. does and has always had a very strong isolationist streak. It goes back more than 100 years. But as Regis said, I fully agree. It's sort of amazing that Trump has asked Putin for advice. And he also asked Putin if it was true that the Russians had tried to tamper in the 2016 elections. And Putin said no. So Trump said publicly, since Putin said that the Russians were not trying to influence the elections, that he believed him. So Trump publicly rejected all the reports from the American intelligence community because he takes Putin at his word. It's pretty stunning.
Bob Woodward's book, by the way, also includes explicative-laden quotes of the current president of the United States. This from the time that Joe Biden was the Veep under Barack Obama. He says, most notably, they effed up in 2014. Biden said to a friend, according to Woodward, that's why we're here. We messed it up. Barack never took Putin seriously. Is that something that haunts you at all, Arisia Lutsevich?
Yes, it was actually in that now what I consider infamous interview in The Atlantic, where Obama said that Russia will always have an escalatory dominance and we shouldn't actually try to deter Russia in Ukraine. And I think, of course, Crimea annexation did happen with very, very little consequences for Russia. The gravest violation of international law happened with the annexation and taking a neighbor's territory by force. And Russia didn't pay a big price. There were some sanctions for irrelevant local elites, right? We played along the game of implausible deniability that Putin imposed on us, saying there were these little green men, whereas I'm sure Barack Obama had intelligence that it was Russian special forces with the Black Sea Fleet who mounted this operation. So I think we gave Russians a free pass to invade more of Ukraine, and we failed in a way to learn a lesson from that. That we need to preposition actually weapons, systems, trainings, and it's only military capability that can, you know, be a serious argument with those specific men in the Kremlin.
Anton Kozlov?
Well, I think before relying on armed forces, I think the United States and Europe, they should do much more in terms of sanctions. And I think the 2014 sanctions had serious consequences, but it's not enough. And certainly this 2022 sanctions had certain impact. But I think there is much more that can be done. And I think that should be done.
But you talk about more sanctions.
Economic sanctions.
But we're seeing, for instance, these ghost ships that are bringing Russian oil to Western Europe.
Yeah, but I mean, you can, first of all, I think the banking sanctions, I mean, not all of the Russian banks are completely isolated. In fact, there are a lot of banks that do have access to
world markets.
Exactly. You know, transportation system. There are a lot of stuff that can be done. That's not done.
Régis Jeanté?
Thinking about what Orissa was saying, this is really the strange way that the politics goes, you know, that was always like this and it will be always like this. But indeed, under Obama, finally, no armament were provided to Ukraine, for example. He was extremely cautious. And finally, under the first mandate of Mr. Trump, more was made, but not thanks to Mr. Trump, even if maybe sometimes he didn't apply his no to some decisions, but because there were some what we call the adults in the room, which were the, you know, the old state servants of the U.S., like Mr. Bolton, Mr. Mattis, Mr. Pompeo, all these people. And this is them who finally, during Trump's mandate, managed to strengthen sometimes even some states from NATO members, had more budget to help this country to strengthen their defense. But of course, the second mandate of Mr. Trump would be very different. And we know he has this project 2025. This is not his project. This is more from his camp with this Heritage Foundation think tank. But that precisely the idea is to push away all the adults in the room to make Mr. Trump able to have his own policy with no one from what he called the deep state, which is a wrong expression, of course, to bother him and to not implement his policy.
So, Jason J. Smart, in light of what Régis is saying, your thoughts on this barnstorming tour of Europe by Volodymyr Zelensky this Thursday. Started the day in London, Paris, Rome. He's going to Berlin. He was the previous day in Croatia for a meeting of regional leaders. What does it seem like when you see the clock ticking towards November the 5th?
I think it's quite clear that everybody's eyes are on the U.S. elections. It's clear the Europeans are watching. The Ukrainians are certainly watching. And most certainly, the Kremlin is watching if their candidate will win. And I think a lot of what's going on now, further decisions, whether it's going to be assistance for Ukraine, forcing Ukraine into peace talks, or otherwise, are all dependent on what happens soon in the U.S. elections. It's going to be determined probably as to how the rest of the war in Ukraine will develop.
Hungary's leader, concluding his big speech as rotating president of the EU Council before the European Parliament Wednesday, with the promise that we can, quote, make Europe great again. Viktor Orban, who likes that line, he insisted that Ukraine cannot win on the battlefield.
Well, that's what we would like to have, to have ceasefire as soon as we can, because I'm convinced personally, strongly, that there is no solution on the battlefield. And I think that the strategy, what we follow as European Union, is not good.
Orissa Lutsevich, is he right? Ukraine cannot win on the battlefield.
I think Régis should write another book about the Putin's man in the Budapest, because there's some interesting sources of his power and how he came to be the leader of Hungary, being previously quite a liberal revolutionary. But I think that Orban specifically repeats a lot of Kremlin's message box lines, including that there's no military solution, whereas it is exactly the only solution with those kinds of, again, Russian leadership, the only argument they understand, the only way to change the course of this war is actually to finally give Ukraine freedom, give Ukraine the ability to perform. As we have seen, Ukrainian armed forces are now the most skilled, I would say, in Europe for sure, or maybe even in the world, in the new age of warfare that includes a lot of, you know, digital. Ukraine is the first country in the world to create a drone army as a separate type of army. And Orban never says that Ukraine has destroyed almost 30% of Russian Black Sea fleet and opened up navigation to those important trade routes for grain and other produce for the global south that otherwise would be starving. So there is a military solution. There has to be a strategy. But, and I think the, part of the that Zelensky is doing now is to convince that there is a military strategy and there should be one in place.
His messaging, Orizia, is kind of, on the one hand, he calls it a victory plan, which, but at the same time, he says we need to be strong militarily so we can negotiate. Sometimes it's difficult to read.
No, it's not difficult to read. You need to make sure that the Russian generals will come to Putin and say, we are losing on the battlefield. And in order to avoid the collapse of the front line that is already starting, we need, you know, to save our faces. Perhaps we could get a better outcome if we add a diplomatic track. Let's remember, right now there is a war and diplomacy is just an extension of what is happening on the battlefield. That is why battlefield is so key. There will not be miraculous diplomatic settlement without a military component.
Anton Kozlov, how much pain is Russia feeling militarily?
Well, I think it does feel pain. It does lose a lot of soldiers, manpower, and a lot of equipment. I don't think you can say that their front line is about to crumble. I don't think, you know, that's the case. I think the problem is that Ukraine is completely outnumbered on the front line. That's the real issue. However, I think that if Ukraine had the right to attack Russian airfields, Russian bases inside, you know, that's what Zelensky had been asking. I think that could definitely change the way the war is going and would bring more chances for a peace settlement. I don't think this war is winnable on either side. I don't think Ukraine can win this war or Russia can win this war. Probably Russia has more chances if it will extend the war for the next 10 years because simply it has a bigger economy and more people.
All right, so they both want to come to a bargaining table eventually in a position of strength. One final question. We've talked oftentimes on this show, Régis Chanté, with guests from former Soviet states like the Baltic states who are very scared that if Vladimir Putin gets his way, gets to annex 20% of Ukraine, which he controls nearly now, what happens next? You hang your hat in Tbilisi. You're our Georgia correspondent. What are the consequences of November 5th and beyond there?
This is seen, of course, as extremely serious, and the dynamics is quite bad indeed. For example, Georgia is about to go back, I would say, in the Russian sphere of influence through political means. But obviously, this is, I would say, one. It's part of the war in Ukraine. We should never forget the war in Ukraine started in Georgia back in 2008. This is the same war, the same method, exactly the same policy that the Kremlin is having. So everybody fears and everybody understands that their fate depends on the war in Ukraine, who will win and if someone will win and so on. So, of course, everybody first looks at what will happen on the 5th of November in the US, but then everybody thinks that the fate of all these countries from Central Asia, from the Caucasus, from Moldova and so on, depends on who will win in Ukraine.
Régis Chanté, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank as well Anton Kozlov, Orizia Lutsevich for being with us from London. Jason J. Smart in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.
Thank you.